Students, and I say the same for other faculty who are out there, including Chris McEvitt, my colleague on the faculty who was also arrested and also harmed.
Annalise Ehrlich, we want to thank you for being with us, professor of history, women's gender and sexuality studies, former chair of Jewish studies at Dartmouth College, where she's taught for more than 30 years. Professor Ehrlich, among dozens of students, faculty, community members arrested at a Dartmouth encampment. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
The New York State Department of Transportation presents How to Navigate a Roundabout. The sign, Roundabout Ahead, means be alert. Look for the directional sign to determine which lane to be in. Check pavement markings to confirm you're in the correct lane. Always watch for and always yield to pedestrians at the crosswalks before entering the roundabout. Enter the roundabout carefully, yielding to oncoming traffic, then proceed counterclockwise. Don't change lanes in the roundabout. Watch the signs to find your exit. Always watch for and always yield to pedestrians at the crosswalks, then safely exit the roundabout.
And keep listening to WUSB Stony Brook while you drive. It will calm you down. It's 6 o'clock. It's a Tuesday night. It's time once again for another edition of Off the Wall. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hello.
And you're telling me to lower my volume a little bit.
I wouldn't.
I'm too loud. In other
words. I can't tell you anything.
No. That's fine. That's fine. Thanks for the coffee, by the way. This is really good.
I'm here to help.
It's a bit hot. What do you got, espresso over there?
Yeah, I got an extra shot through.
It looks more dignified somehow than the big, massive cup of coffee I have. But I need it. I need it to get through the day. I really do. And my day is beginning right now. We have a lot to talk about tonight. Boy, a lot's been going on. The last couple of weeks, we've been talking about the protests that have been going on all throughout the country. And tonight, we're going to be talking about that again. Hey, it's local now. It's right here at Stony Brook. So we'll certainly be mentioning that. But first, I wanted to just go over a couple of headlines, which might be of interest to people in these United States of ours. A teenage pizza delivery driver who parked in the wrong driveway of a Middle Tennessee home. Do I have to finish a sentence? This is America in the 21st century. What do you think happened? The homeowner shot at him multiple times for parking in the wrong driveway while delivering a pizza. Took place last Monday night on a residential street in Ashland City, about 20 miles northwest of Nashville. I don't know why we need to know exactly where it is. I guess, okay, that's where the crazy people are. 20 miles northwest of Nashville. No, they're everywhere. They're everywhere. They're here, too, in New York, in Suffolk County. Park in the wrong driveway, you get shot at. And that is how people believe we should be living our lives.
Well, let's just be real. I mean, have there been driveway assaults in the last 30 days in Suffolk County?
What is a driveway assault? I'm sure there have been.
There probably have been, but I think people would know a pizza delivery because there's lots of food delivery
out here.
Well,
people don't know anything, really. And here's the thing. It's one of these neighborhoods where all the driveways are next to each other. You know, there's no trees or anything, and it's one of these, you know, compact, live like an ant colony type places. And, the poor kid parked in the one next to the one that he thought he was going to. And so, the suspect got his 9mm handgun, went outside and began shooting at the truck to try to disable it. Because we're living in Mad Max world. Disgusting. What else? This is a good one. This just happened today. An upstate judge named Daniel J. Doyle, a Republican, ruled today that a proposed abortion rights amendment should be stricken from the statewide ballot this fall because lawmakers missed a critical constitutional step. Yeah, so how about that? We don't get to vote on it because this guy rules that there's been a mistake. The proposed equal rights amendment is scheduled to be voted on by New Yorkers November 5th. It would, among other things, enshrine abortion rights in the New York Constitution at a time when other states are seeking to restrict access to abortion services, restrict or just forbid entirely. Fortunately, Attorney General Letitia James, Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins of Yonkers said the decision will be appealed, and hopefully this nonsense can be put behind us. Every time there's something that looks to be the right decision, there's some redneck judge someplace that steps in and has the power to just stop the whole thing. And finally, right here in Port Jefferson, workers at the Port Jefferson Starbucks have filed a petition seeking to hold a union election vote in the coming weeks. Yeah, that's right. They're right in our backyard. The employees, 201 Main Street, I don't know why we have to give the address, but they're right there on Main Street. They signed union cards with the National Labor Relations Board on Monday, seeking to hold a union vote. They're aiming to join the Workers United New York, New Jersey Regional Board, which is an affiliate of the Service Employees International Union. And if you think that's somehow a threat to anybody, I'd love to know your rationale. I really would. Anyway, it's required that workers seeking an election submit union cards or a petition signed by at least 30% of the workers eligible to vote in a union election. And employees at the Port Jefferson shop met that requirement. So, we could actually have a unionized Port Jefferson Starbucks, and I don't think it would affect the customers at all. It would be the 8th Starbucks on Long Island to unionize if workers vote in favor of joining Workers United. Employees at stores in Farmingville, Westbury, Lynbrook, Massapequa, Wantagh, Old Westbury, and Garden City have joined the union since 2022. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. You know, and also there's some other news from Port Jefferson you might not have heard of. Port Jefferson is getting a fourth ferry. Yeah, there have been three ferries in Port Jefferson going to Bridgeport for the longest time. Can you name them, Kyle? Can you name the ferries? Or any ferry I'll accept.
The P.T. Barnum.
P.T. Barnum.
The Park because, City.
Park City, that's two.
And the...
why are you thinking? Let me just say that.
Billy Goat's Gruff.
No, that's not right. P.T. Barnum, that was the Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey Circus. He used to live there in Port Jefferson. In fact, I think there's a Barnum Avenue or something, and there was a house. He kept all his elephants there. I don't know about that, but yeah, there's a link, and that's why it's called P.T. Barnum. The third ferry that you're trying to think of is the Grand Republic.
Grand Republic.
I think that's actually the oldest one. Extra point. And you couldn't possibly know this, but what was the name of the ferry before those three? Because there used to be only one. That was a long time ago. Before your time.
I'm supposed to have all the time in my head.
Well, just... you know, some people read books and study history, and maybe that's part of the history.
Oh, that's another thing I have to work on.
I'm just saying, as an educational radio station, we try to teach people things.
But there's a lot of other teachers. I feel like I'm taking up space here. This is valuable community radio airtime.
Now you're learning. You're not teaching right now. You're learning. So learn this, Kyle.
All right. I'm going to pause for the learning.
It was the Martha's Vineyard.
That sounds that familiar.
I can't pronounce that.
Is there an apostrophe?
Martha's Vineyard. That's the way to say it. I'm sure there was an apostrophe. And you're alluding to a story we heard recently about street signs. Where was that? Somewhere in, what was it, in the UK? It was someplace where they're eliminating apostrophes and special characters like dashes. You couldn't have a dash between two words in a street sign. It's insane. But they're saying because, you know, people don't type this on the internet, we should not have them on signs. So we're getting less and less literate as we progress further and further technologically. Bad idea. Very bad idea. Anyway, getting back to the Port Jefferson ferry number four. They didn't exactly stay up late thinking of a name for this thing. And I'm kind of disappointed in that. And I hope whoever is in charge is either going to reconsider or perhaps we could appeal what they are calling this thing. Because, you know, if you're going to name a ferry, it should be named something really cool. You know, named after a person, you know, like the tugboat was named after our friend Mike Juhas, the H. Michael Juhas on the Mississippi River. That's a good name. I'm not saying name the Port Jefferson Ferry that, even though he used to live in Port Jefferson. No. But I am saying calling it Long Island is not very imaginative. And first of all, it makes the other three ferries feel bad because that's the only one that's relevant, you know, to the area. It's the only one coming to Long Island. The other three come to Long Island as well, but they're not called the Long Island. No, we can do better than that. So I'd like to hear suggestions. otw@2600.com. If you have suggestions to what to name the fourth ferry, that's actually a good name. That would be nice. Okay, getting to the, I guess you call them the pro-Palestinian protests that have been taking place all throughout the country, throughout the world, in fact, but quite a bit in the United States because... there's been so much student activity on that subject in the past month or so. Overdue, I think. And last Tuesday was really a pivotal point. You know, we talked about it on this show, but after the show, all kinds of things happened. We saw the occupation of the building at Columbia University. There was some activity on the West Coast. I'm going to go through what happened on Tuesday night. But what was particularly interesting, we were driving around listening to WKCR, which is at 89.9 in New York City, Columbia University's radio station. And they did an incredible job with their student journalists going out onto the field and reporting what was happening. Nobody else was doing this. First of all, the press was barred because that's where we are these days. The press was simply prevented from covering the story by the authorities. It's kind of like Gaza itself. You know, they couldn't get in, but these guys were already there because they're on campus. So if you listen to them during this protest, during the takeover of the building, you got to hear things that were not heard anywhere else in the media. And it was just fascinating listening to them were able to use an app to be able to listen to them outside of their broadcast area and learn quite a bit. And shortly after that, we discovered that there was actually a protest going on right here on the campus of the State University at Stony Brook. And I was just so thrilled to learn that, okay, yeah, there's people paying attention. There's something going on. It doesn't matter how you feel about the issue. Just the fact that people care and are willing to stand up for what they believe in. So, you know, we happened to be on campus for other reasons and realized this was going on right at this moment. It was later in the evening, about, I think, 10 o'clock. And so we walked over to a place on campus known as the Stoller Steps. It's right by the Stoller Fine Arts Center. And it's basically a bunch of steps with some grass. They've made it look really nice over the years. And what we found there were a bunch of people that were basically camped out on the grounds. They were not in tents. And this was what was so incredible. Originally, they were in tents. But then they were told by the university, tents are not allowed. You know, they just kind of like made that up, but said, yeah, tents are not allowed on the grass. And rather than fight that, they simply got rid of the tents and they were lying there in sleeping bags. They were just lying on the grass in sleeping bags. It was it was really something to see. And they had signs up on the wall of the building, the fine arts building next door, and had signs like Sikhs for Palestine, Nepal for Palestine, Korea for free Palestine, BLM for Palestine. Just all these signs basically saying we're from this particular part of the world, or we represent this movement, and we support freedom for you guys. And I don't know, at that moment, you know, walking onto that site of my old alma mater, I was just so proud because they were doing such an admirable job expressing themselves, being completely peaceful. I mean, it was really quiet. Everybody was, I guess, going to sleep at that point, but they were just, it just seemed so sincere. Had their signs up. They conceded the tent issue and was simply lying on the grass in sleeping bags, and there were even university police officers standing by, and you know even they were kids, you know they looked like they were in school themselves, but they were no threat whatsoever. They were just hanging out, making sure everything was peaceful, and at that moment I could not have been prouder to have been affiliated with Stony Brook. Seeing that. We'll get back to what happened at Stony Brook the next day, but I want to stay with Tuesday night for now because what was going on at Columbia was not so peaceful, not so nice. Hamilton Hall was the building that the students had been occupying, and this is nothing new. We talked about it last week. Hamilton Hall has been occupied time and time again over the years. It's apparently the place students go and take over. I don't know why they take over this building. I don't know exactly what it is. But the way the media, the mass media was dealing with it was like some kind of invasion. You know, it's a building. You trick somebody into staying inside the building after it closes. And then that person lets everybody else in. And then everybody's in the building. That's it. That's how it works. It's not that hard to do. And they've done it before in this building. It's kind of tradition. It's history. But the way that it was portrayed in the media made it seem so much more evil. Now, okay, so they're inside the building. What's the big deal exactly? They're making a statement. They're inside. Maybe let this peter out over a couple of days. Let people express themselves. I don't know, Kyle, we were listening to this and it seemed like this was just being blown out of proportion by the university, by the media, by elected officials.
Yeah, they had sort of changed tactics as we were engaging in some of the best coverage we could find. So it really was jarring, I think, to everyone that something that had been done in the past was just simply not going to be tolerated. And it felt like there was just several different lines or triggers that they were changing that, mm-hmm. Instead of permitting some of the stuff that was going on. But I'm not totally sure where we're at in the timeline, though.
Well, timeline is Tuesday night, and the cops moved in to retake Hamilton Hall because apparently that was really important to them. And in the process, they fired their weapons inside Hamilton Hall. Now, you talk about outside agitators. What could be more agitating than somebody bursting into a building and firing a gun? Yeah, New York's finest. Yeah, it was an accident, but accidents happen when you're not being careful. And if you're a cop, you need to be careful, especially in situations like that. Thank God nobody was hurt, but someone could have been killed. And not through the actions of the protesters, through the actions of the university for calling in the cops and, of course, the cops themselves. Now, the incident is under review by the Manhattan District Attorney. Wouldn't expect much movement on that. The gun fired did not appear to be aimed at anyone. What a relief. And no one was injured, said Doug Cohen, a spokesperson for the Manhattan Attorney General, District Attorney's Office. Cohen said no students, only police officers were in the immediate vicinity when the shooting occurred. Now, apparently, what happened here was the cop was trying to get to his flashlight. And I don't know why a flashlight would be anywhere near a gun, but apparently that is how you access the flashlight, by accessing the gun at the same time. So, yeah, not really the best there. Multiple television, radio appearances, press conference Wednesday morning. Mayor Eric Adams did nothing but praise the NYPD's precision. Why can I say that word? Precision policing, and made no mention of the shooting. No mention at all. And during the raids at both Columbia and City College, a few blocks to the south, police blocked press access almost entirely, though they released a highly edited, flashy video of dozens of officers storming the Ivy League campus, breaking through barricaded doors and locks of the occupied hall, where demonstrators had barricaded themselves into early Tuesday morning. And in one shot, officers entered a room in Hamilton Hall with weapons drawn. Why? What's the reason for that? The video also shows officers using flashbangs or stun grenades. Really? According to a veteran law enforcement official, it's pretty unusual to use flashbangs for something like this, absent some intel about a serious threat to officers. I've never seen them used for search warrants involving guns, let alone some barricaded college kids. This is how you treat your students. Flashbangs, another word they really didn't think hard on what to name, but that's what they do. They flash and they bang. Columbia University had first called police in to clear student demonstrators calling for the university to divest from Israel on April 18th, with more than 100 arrests. In the following days, as another even larger encampment of students grew in an adjacent lawn, sparking similar protests at universities nationwide, President Menashe Shafik expressed reluctance to involve police again. But that changed after the Hamilton Hall takeover Tuesday morning, which she said gave the university no choice but to involve police again. No choice. Seems to me you had a choice. Don't do that. Let them stay in the hall. Let them express themselves. Listen to them. Talk to them. See how that goes. She didn't even give it one day. Not one day. Now, even before the raids, Mayor Adams, other top NYPD officials, had begun blaming outside agitators for a fermenting protest on college campuses, with limited evidence to back that claim. And on Thursday evening, City Hall released a breakdown of those arrested in campus protests at Columbia and City College. People who are unaffiliated with those schools saying those people, who the mayor has called agitators, accounted for nearly 30% of the 112 demonstrators arrested at Columbia, 60% of those arrested by City College. I don't see the big deal. I mean, you know, it's open campus. People are welcome to come on for other things. So if they're not behaving in a particularly harmful way, I don't really see this as significant. The outside agitators, you know, the armed thugs that you call in, you know, those people who have probably never seen a college campus before, you know, using violence, using intimidation. They're the outside agitators. You're the outside agitator, Mayor Adams. Let the students work it out. Let the school work it out. And apparently the university president does not understand that. Apparently all university presidents don't seem to understand that. There's a situation where a student was pushed down the stairs, not receiving medical attention for over an hour in the midst of what students described as something that felt like a military operation. Because it was. Because it was. Our police have been militarized. That's been going on for a while. Well, here it is, being used against us. There is an account of an officer who threw flash grenades across a barrier without any sense of how many people were behind it, including undergraduates. And then you had this story in Fox News, of course. Headline, NYPD gives chilling update after 56 arrested at NYU, a new school. There's somebody behind this movement. Yeah, you think somebody might be behind the movement. It wasn't a coincidence that all these people gathered together. Yeah, they planned it. They organized it. Imagine that. NYPD Deputy Commissioner of Operations Kaz Daughtry, another work of art here, spoke to reporters saying there is somebody or some organization behind the massive movement where students and other protesters are taking over schools and academic buildings, chanting anti-Semitic slogans. So we'll get to that. Resisting law enforcement and administrators' orders to disperse and getting away with little to no consequences. Really, being arrested? No consequence? Being thrown down the stairs? No consequence? Having flashbangs thrown at you? No consequence? Almost being shot at by an idiot cop? No consequences. I'd like to see consequences for the people that instigated the violence. And those are the cops. Those are the university administrators. Anyway, Daughtry continued, and this is what makes the story so entertaining. I just want to say, and I said it before, there's somebody behind this movement. There is some organization behind this movement. The level of organization that we're seeing in both of these schools and at Columbia. They found leaflets with all the details provided to the protesters. Daughtry continued, there are leaflets on how to protest. On how to protest leaflets? Okay, I'm not sure what this sentence means. There are leaflets on how to protest. Let's just leave it at that. Or how to commit civil disobedience. There are leaflets on what to do when you get arrested. Leaflets on what to say to police. Yeah, you know what? These leaflets are probably made by the ACLU. I have these leaflets. Everyone should have these leaflets. What do you say to a cop? You know, what are your rights? And this is a threat to the deputy commissioner of the NYPD. People knowing their rights. Well, yeah, I guess of course it is. He continued, because boy, this guy does not shut up. There is somebody funding this. There is somebody radicalizing our students. Really? That's what you take out of this. That students are being radicalized because they're educated on how to deal with cops when they get violently assaulted or otherwise arrested. What are their rights? That to you is radicalizing. Insane. During the remarks, and this is interesting, the police chief noted that 99% of those arrested on Friday were students. Kind of not what's being reported everywhere else. So 99% were students. So, all right. I guess you'll turn that into something evil as well. They read some of the literature. Enter the temporary autonomous zone from New York to Gaza. Disrupt, reclaim, destroy Zionist business interest everywhere. I have a problem with that last sentence. But again, we'll get to that. Long live the Intifada. Read another. I don't really have a problem with that sentence. But they said this is the mindset of some of these protests for sure. The NYPD chief of patrol also said responding officers gave the protesters at NYU multiple options for them to leave peacefully and clear the scene without being arrested. A couple said, "I want to be arrested." And we said, "Okay." I've been in groups like that where people want to make a statement. They want to commit civil disobedience. They want to be arrested. It's not that unusual a thing if you're making a statement. The way that these students are being described and dealt with as if they're some kind of terrorists, you know, it's scary. It's super scary. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like if you're one of those kids. This is how society treats you. This is how your university treats you. Moving on to UCLA out in California. Story from the LA Times. Police report no serious injuries, but scenes from inside UCLA camp. Protesters tell a different story. It was a request police had made repeatedly. Stop throwing things at officers. But as pro-Palestinian demonstrators made their last stand Thursday morning in defense of the encampment they'd occupied at UCLA for the better part of a week, some protesters did not comply. And after another piece of wood or a plastic water bottle was flung toward law enforcement, demonstrators would yell for the others to stop hurling projectiles, but still they kept flying. Shows that you can't control everybody in a group, even if you're part of the group. The police, decked out in full riot gear, so really not much threat from a plastic water bottle. But still, you shouldn't do it. I agree with that, but they're decked out in full riot gear. These protesters are not. But they had enough. One officer raised the barrel of his gun in the direction of a frontline demonstrator and shot him square in the chest with a less lethal round that made a deep thud as it connected. Proud of yourself? The protester fell to the ground where he remained in a ball for about a minute while others called for a medic. A couple of people with red crosses emblazoned on their protective gear made their way through the mass of bodies and picked up the demonstrator. They quickly hauled him off to the medical tent at the center of the encampment where a few other protesters were being treated for injuries. In a Thursday statement, the UCLA Palestine Solidarity Encampment decried law enforcement's actions. They tore students from our human chain and shot rubber bullets at close range. Many were rushed to the ER after the bullets connected with heads and hands. The UCLA branch of Students for Justice in Palestine posted on Twitter, there were at least five people shot in the head with rubber bullets. With the help of bulldozers, items including tents, chairs, and yoga mats were removed. You know, this is what they do in the occupied territories. They use bulldozers to tear down the houses. I mean, do they not see the optics of this? How this is really, really a bad look for them to use bulldozers to tear down tents of students who go to that university. Shoved everything into a gray dumpster. LA Times reporters, photojournalists witnessed several instances of protesters being injured during the clearing of the UCLA encampment. Yet the LAPD interim chief, Dominic Troy, less than 12 hours later, expressed relief. "I am thankful there were no serious injuries to officers or protesters." Asked how Troy was able to make that determination so quickly and whether the LAPD had any more information about injuries, serious or not, the department directed all inquiries to UCLA. So that's a big middle finger to UCLA from the cops. It's like, yeah, you know, if anyone got hurt, it's on them. We know nothing. And of course, no further information was obtained from UCLA. One man shot with a less lethal round needed surgery on his finger, which was so badly hurt that doctors considered amputation, according to a person who was with him on the front line. Another man posted pictures of himself on social media, 8:45 a.m. on Thursday, with a bloody head bandage and bloodstained T-shirt. He wrote that he had been shot with a less lethal round and that he was leaving the hospital now with 11 staples and 4 stitches, adding that despite all this, "I'm so proud of everyone that was there tonight." And then, of course, there's what many of us might have witnessed Tuesday night at UCLA before they moved in on the protesters. before the cops moved in on the protesters. Because what actually happened was that counter-protesters showed up. Counter-protesters showed up. This was live on television. I was watching this Tuesday night. I could not believe what I was seeing. I was seeing these kids in their tents being beaten by thugs with sticks, having their stuff basically torn apart, mobs descending on single people, and absolutely no cops whatsoever. A New York Times examination of more than 100 videos from clashes at the University of California in Los Angeles found that the violence continued for nearly 5 hours with little or no police intervention. The violence had been instigated by dozens of people who are seen in videos counter-protesting the encampment. They did this for several hours, beating them with sticks, using chemical sprays, launching fireworks as weapons. And as of Friday, no arrests have been made in connection with the attack. Not one. The melee began when a group of counter-protesters started tearing away metal barriers that had been in place to cordon off pro-Palestinian protesters. Security personnel hired by the university are seen in yellow vests standing to the side throughout the incident, doing absolutely nothing. It's not clear how the counter-protest was organized or what allegiances people committing the violence had, but the videos showed many of the counter-protesters were wearing pro-Israel slogans on their clothing. Some counter-protesters blared music, including Israel's national anthem, a Hebrew children's song, and Harbu Darbu, an Israeli song about the Israeli Defense Forces campaign in Gaza. They have a song. As counter-protesters tossed away metal barricades, one of them was seen trying to strike a person near the encampment. Another threw a piece of wood into it. Some of the first signs of violence. This continued for nearly 3 hours before police even got there. Counter-protesters shot fireworks toward the encampment at least 6 times, according to videos analyzed by the New York Times. One of them went off inside, causing protesters to scream. Another exploded at the edge of the encampment. One was thrown in the direction of a group of protesters who were carrying an injured person out of the encampment. Some counter-protesters sprayed chemicals both into the encampment and directly at people's faces. At times, counter-protesters swarmed individuals. Sometimes a group descended on a single person. They could be seen punching, kicking, and attacking people with makeshift weapons, including sticks, traffic cones, and wooden boards. Except for a brief attempt to capture a loudspeaker used by counter-protesters and water bottles, plastic water bottles being tossed out of the encampment, none of the videos analyzed by the Times show any clear instance of encampment protesters initiating confrontations with counter-protesters beyond defending the barricades. Shortly before 1 a.m., more than 2 hours after the violence erupted, a spokesperson with the mayor's office posted a statement that said UCLA officials had called the LAPD to help, and they were responding immediately. About an hour later, the California Highway Patrol began assembling nearby. Riot police with the LAPD joined them a few minutes later. That was an hour after they were called. Counter-protesters applauded their arrival. The counter-protesters, the ones attacking, applauded their arrival, chanting, USA, USA. And after the officers arrived, counter-protesters continued to attack a man standing right near them. 20 minutes after they arrived, a video shows a counter-protester spraying a chemical towards an encampment during a scuffle over a metal barricade. Another counter-protester can be seen punching someone in the head near the encampment after swinging a plank at the barricades. Throughout the violence, officers were captured on video, not stepping in. It was not until 2:42 a.m. that they began to move toward the encampment, after which counter-protesters dispersed and the violence finally came to an end. And the night after that attack, the cops moved in on the demonstrators, the pro-Palestinian demonstrators, and arrested more than 200 people. Again, not one of the attackers was arrested or even identified yet. There are people on the internet working on that. And now we come back to Stony Brook. place I was so proud of, the place I thought was not like this. Well, turns out we are. In the early hours of Thursday morning, approximately 12:15 a.m., about a day after, I'd witnessed them, protesters lying on the grass with their signs up on walls, expressing themselves. According to this this story from the Times Beacon newspaper, local newspaper, Stony Brook University was rocked by a series of events that culminated in the arrest of 29 individuals, including students, faculty members, and external affiliates. What began as a peaceful demonstration on the university's Stoller steps escalated into a tense standoff between protesters and university officials, ultimately resulting in police intervention. Now, the problem with this story is only the university was spoken to. Nobody from the protesters was spoken to. So all we have here is a university statement. And that statement expressed disappointment at the turn of events. One has to ask, well, what made them turn? According to university officials, efforts were made to de-escalate tensions throughout the day on Wednesday, with administrators offering to meet with protest leaders to discuss their grievances. However, these attempts were rebuffed, and the situation continued to deteriorate as protesters erected tents, after all, and engaged in behavior that violated university policies. Well, let me explain something to university administrators. A protest, by nature, defies policies. If you're setting up some kind of a protest movement, you're going to do things that the university doesn't want you to do. That's the whole point of protesting. You have to ask yourself, is a tent really that big a deal? And as far as discussing their grievances, well, why not discuss the grievances while they're there? Because my understanding is they were offering to discuss their grievances after they left. Now, I don't know. To me, it doesn't seem like that's a very effective way of demonstrating, to stop demonstrating before you can start talking about what you're upset about. The time to have the conversation is when it's going on. Right? I mean, that's protest 101. According to University President Maury McGinnis, what began on Tuesday as a peaceful demonstration in compliance with our rules escalated to include intimidation and harassment of other students, the erection of tents in violation of the university's policy, and the continued occupation of a space that must continue to be available to other student groups that have reserved its use well in advance. Well, okay, first of all, the tent, that's easy to point to and say, there's the tent. Violation. Put up a tent. As far as the intimidation and harassment of other students, I've heard this quote from Maury McGinnis many, many times. I have not seen anything more specific. I'm not saying it's impossible something like that could have happened, but what specifically are you referring to? What intimidation? What harassment? What I saw was completely peaceful. Now, of course, that could change, obviously. But if somebody did something specifically, you'd think they'd be talking about what it was they did specifically. I know in other colleges, some students claim that they felt uncomfortable, and I get that. They felt uncomfortable, but is that it? You just felt uncomfortable, or were you somehow attacked or intimidated? Some people said that they couldn't get to their classes because the demonstrators were blocking the path. I mean, you go around them like everybody else has to. Seems like the easy solution to that. Unless you specifically are being prevented from moving about freely. But again, I haven't seen that particularly stated in, you know, with specifics. And that's very, very important. Now, as far as another group, and this is interesting, another group reserving the same space on the Stoller steps. Well, interestingly enough, there was, I believe it's called a block party, that was reserved by a Jewish student organization, an annual event. They reserved it in advance. Indisputable. Yeah, they did that. And it just seems to me, you know, the optics of this don't look good either. You know, a bunch of Jewish students displacing a Palestinian demonstration. It's just kind of a little ironic there.
It's almost as if the Staller Center stage was just turned like 180 degrees and it was like playing out as a satire or like drama of itself.
Well, there were so many parallels when you look at what's going on university campuses to what's going on in the Middle East, the heavy handedness of dealing with people doing something as innocent as raising a Palestinian flag or a bunch of kids throwing a stone at a tank. You know, well, they're throwing stones at a tank. We had to obliterate them. You know, idiocy like that. We're seeing the same type of reaction on a different scale. And it's disgusting to see that at my school. You know, it enrages me. It absolutely enrages me to see that. Now, okay, so what do you do about the Jewish students that had that space reserved? Well, you know, okay, I'm naive, you know, I'm simplistic at times, and, you know, I know it's not going to work, I know it's impossible, but what if those kids said, hey, fellow classmates, we might not agree with you, but we respect your right to demonstrate, take the space. In fact, we'll hang out with you. I mean, you know, it's definitely different than how everybody else deals with it, but that could have been a breakthrough of one sort or another. I mean, at least give it a try. Your event was already going to be greatly diminished. And it was. It was, I think, about a quarter of what they expected it to be because of all this. So, you know, and the university, you know, we have lots of spaces on campus. Put them someplace else. Compromise a little bit. Don't be so... Ugh.
The school could have done a bit of support in mediating a lot of that. Through conversations with faculty, and I think there's some blind spots there.
I think they were panicking. I think what Maureen McGinnis was thinking was, oh my God, there's going to be a confrontation between Palestinian demonstrators and Jewish students. That's what I think she was thinking. That's what I think the administration was thinking, you know, and not giving enough credit to the maturity of Stony Brook students. I think they could have worked this through given the right atmosphere. The atmosphere that she gave them, that's going to stick with them for the rest of their lives. That this heavy-handed approach is the solution. This is what she says. I am deeply saddened that we reached the point where police intervention became necessary. Really? Because you're the one that made it happen. And one day... That's it. This wasn't exactly an occupation that was going on, you know, for days, weeks, months. It was 24 hours outside. It wasn't even a building being occupied. They were sitting on the grass. She continued, university administrators made every effort to avert this outcome. No, they did not. Nevertheless, I want to express my appreciation to all involved for the peaceful manner in which the events of yesterday evening unfolded. Okay, I don't know if she was there. I don't know if she was watching the news or reading the newspapers. What I saw, and I saw a video, this was on News 12, I saw a bunch of different cops. I saw university police standing by. I saw state troopers with their, you know, hats and all that. They were the ones leading people away after they got arrested. Then I saw these thugs from Suffolk County Police going up to people, screaming in their faces to comply or else, throwing them to the ground. These are people that weren't doing anything other than existing, other than being there. And that is how they are treated at the Stony Brook campus. It's disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. I've not seen anything like that in all the time I've been at Stony Brook. And I guarantee you, all these university presidents, these university presidents that are making these dumbass decisions and calling in the authorities and traumatizing kids for standing up for what they believe in, I guarantee you they have not gone to that school. And that should be a rule. A university president should have attended the school that they are now ruling over. Because I guarantee you this, nobody who attends a campus like Stony Brook would do that to Stony Brook. You would have some allegiance. You would have some kind of emotional feeling that would say, oh, this is my school. I can't do this. I can't have cops come in and brutalize these kids just for saying something that maybe I don't agree with or other people don't agree with. She continued with the usual, the police acted professionally and with restraint. Yeah, that was restraint. That was restraint. Throwing it to the ground, screaming in their faces. Boy, I guess they didn't shoot them, so give them credit for that. Most of our students comported themselves peacefully and with dignity in a manner that contrasts sharply with the scenes we are seeing from many other campuses. No, that's not true. I wish it were true. It was true on Tuesday night. I was so proud of my campus on Tuesday night when I saw kids expressing themselves, being peaceful, and the cops standing by, you know, brothers, basically, the people who are part of the university, taking care of each other. What's happened since the Faculty Senate at Stony Brook University voted overwhelmingly yesterday to demand that the school drop charges against 29 students and faculty arrested in connection with pro-Palestine protest last week. In a heated meeting that also was attended by the university president, Maury McGinnis, the Senate also voted to investigate a new campus police operation McGinnis has created. You gotta hear this. Speakers noted the campus police seized the cell phones of some of the protesters and refused to return them in what some professors are characterizing as an action more typical of an authoritarian police state. Right here at Stony Brook, authoritarian police state. The Senate tabled for a week a third resolution declaring no confidence in President McGinnis's capacity to perform the ongoing duties of her office in a wise and humane manner. The resolution to demand charges be dropped is largely symbolic, as the group has no direct power, but whatever. McGinnis, during the nearly two-hour meeting, vehemently defended her handling of last week's protest, saying university officials were put in an extremely difficult position, did their best to defuse a volatile situation. Well, newsflash, their best was nowhere near good enough. We did not want to arrest anyone, she said. We wanted to de-escalate the situation. Nice job! Nice job. Way to de-escalate the situation. Bring in cops and throw people to the ground and scream at them. Force them out of the place. Whatever you do, don't talk to them. She noted, and this is her bar, protests at other colleges around the country have ended far worse. Columbia University has canceled its main graduation after nearly 300 people were arrested there, along with City College of New York. Hey, Stony Brook, graduation's a week from Friday. Will there be disruption? Probably. Hopefully. You see, I look at protest as an inherent right of all of us to express ourselves. What is so bad about somebody saying something that might differ from what you believe in, that might throw people off slightly? It's not a terrorist act. It's speech. It's opinion. It's people educating themselves in one way or another. Now, let's get to the objectionable things that we alluded to earlier. There are words that are used, such as, you know, shut down Zionist businesses or use of certain symbols and signs. You know, the Anti-Defamation League actually published some evidence of pictures.
Hate symbols.
Hate symbol. I mean, you could describe them as hate symbols. But here's the thing. Words mean different things to different people. Zionist, as we just heard in Democracy Now!, can mean very different things, depending on the context. There are plenty of Jewish people who are anti-Zionist. They're not anti-Semitic. Anti-Semitism is not the same as anti-Zionism. Now, there are anti-Semitic people who are also anti-Zionist. But we need to define our terms. We can't simply label everybody as anti-Semitic if they use a word in the way that we believe it should be used and not think of the way that they are using that particular word. Intifada, for instance, is a word for fighting back from the early 21st century that initially was fairly nonviolent, but it basically it symbolized people who had nothing fighting back against this massive military force. Inspirational. And that's the way that that particular word is being used. It doesn't mean kill the Jews. It doesn't mean anti-Semitism. Not necessarily. You don't know what people are thinking. You can't speak for everybody. But I think, you know, the students in most of these places, the educated students, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's have a conversation. If there is something that we find offensive, let's explain to them why, instead of labeling them as all the same. For instance, what ADL did was they pointed out red triangles have been used by Hamas. They've been co-opted by Hamas. A red triangle also happens to be part of the Palestinian flag. So people are using that as a symbol. Maybe they're not aware that it's something that Hamas has co-opted. Maybe they're not aware of certain faces and pictures and things like that, or even phrases, from the river to the sea. That affects some people in one way. Other people think of it in a completely different way. So let's not be so quick to label everybody and say that if they use this word, they mean that, because odds are they probably don't. Yeah, so that's what's been going on this week. It's been a busy week, and it's not going to stop anytime soon. It's really naive to assume that it will. You know, we have Al Jazeera being kicked out of Israel now by Netanyahu. The country is becoming more of a fascist regime week by week. And people wonder why Hamas gets support. This is why people are driven to them. There are so many ways to avoid this. And we seem to be failing on every front. I wish we had more time to talk about options, other things that can be done. But let me just say, they involve dialogue, communication, not canceling people, not condemning people, learning where other people are coming from. And that's what a university is all about. So I hope President McGinnis hears that. And there's no law that says a university president can't learn at a university. All right, that's it for us. Keep thinking in a rebellious way. It's always good. It's always healthy. It's what I learned at Stony Brook. And, you know, I gave the graduation speech there, and I went off script. I think we all need to go off script. And we'll get it wrong sometimes. We'll get it right more times than we think. OTW at 2600.com. We'll see you next week. Good night.
Bye.
I was walking down the street in the town I was born. I was moving to a beat that I never felt before. A silhouette opened up my eyes and I took a look around. I saw you written across the sky. The revolution starts now. She starts now. The revolution starts now. Only rise above the fear. But here the walls are raining down. The revolution starts here. The way you work and the way you play. The way you lay them up and down. Doing what you see, the revolution starts now. Yeah, the revolution starts now. Yeah, the revolution starts now. In your own backyard, in your own hometown. What you do is standing around, just follow your heart to revolution. She starts now. hope to come to be. And people gather around, they have all they can bring. I'm saying the revolution starts now. Come here to the show.